Well, U.S. stocks roared back to life on Wall Street the third week running. The Dow Jones Industrials added about 240 points. Well, welcome to Gold Seek Radio. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you. We've got another super-sized show in store. After five tough years, gold is up about 10% for the year. But where will it end 2016? Joining me with his thoughts, Bill Murphy from Gotta.org says the gold cartel has lost control. They're having trouble suppressing price due to record global demand. He points out the HUI Leveraged Shares Index added 70% in just 6 weeks in the mining sector. Plus, Fed officials and their colleagues are decidedly dovish. We may not even see another rate hike in 2016. According to the Fed Funds futures. But it's silver that Bill Murphy likes the most, calling for at least a 10-fold increase. That's a 1,000% return. Then Monty Guild of Guild Investment Management returns to the show. He says China is accumulating huge gold reserves under the table at deep discount prices. And many countries have sold off most of their stockpiles. And distrust in government policies is leading investors in droves to the precious metals market. He expects that trend to continue in the oil market in the next few months on OPEC member supply limits. And then he shares one of his favorite technology stocks. Robert Ian joins the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the New York Comex Exchange amid a U.S. dollar rally on stronger-than-expected GDP numbers. By Friday's closing bell, the yellow metal was off only $3.80, virtually the unchanged level. Silver finished at $14.69, off about 40 cents, 2.5%, while the XAU and silver index finished near the break-even point at 62. And West Texas Intermediate crude added $2.70, 10% for the week at $31.70 per barrel. Gold is higher by roughly 10% for the year, registering the best monthly performance in 4 years. The yellow metal is the top-performing commodity in the CRB index this year, and investors are shying away from paper assets, such as stocks and bonds, preferring the return of their funds over the return on their funds. In addition, a top-ranked gold forecaster is calling for $1,400 per ounce this year after the current corrective wave passes. Although the U.S. dollar rally weighed heavily on the sector, without Fed rate support, it could fade, setting the stage for another leg higher in the sector. Precious metals bottom line. Well, the markets fell through support this week, suggesting some more selling amid a stronger-than-expected U.S. dollar. However, with the Fed's hands tied for now on rate hikes, precious metals hopefully will hold support at recent lows. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange. News of stronger-than-anticipated GDP numbers indicated the domestic economy may be more robust than predicted, encouraging investors to pick up U.S. shares at a discount for the third week running. The Dow finished at 16,639, up 247 points, 1.5% for the week, while the S&P 500 finished at 1948, up 30, 1.5%, and the NASDAQ was higher by 86, 2%, at 44.25. According to a Commerce Department report this week, the gross domestic product grew at a 1% annualized rate, topping initial forecasts by 0.3%. Nevertheless, the sluggish 1% growth rate is hardly reason to expect further Fed rate hikes. In fact, a sea change of sentiment in the Fed Funds futures contract indicates investors are now putting greater than even odds that the Fed will hold rates steady for the next 12 months at the unchanged or 0.5% level. Bottom line on Wall Street. The CBOT, VIX, and VVIX all suggest further upside potential in U.S. equities in the next few weeks, and the fear-greed index indicates a neutral tone. The sum total suggests more blue skies are possible, or at least sideways action, in the coming weeks. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. Monty Guild, a recognized expert in the areas of economics, finance for several decades. He is a well-known speaker, writer, widely quoted in the major media outlets. Welcome back, Monty Guild.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you back on the show here. Actually, it's fortuitous because there's so much going on in the markets, volatility increasing. And not to mention, I was speaking with one of your colleagues there, Tim Sharita, before the show, just back from Europe. We were discussing May 1, never live in interesting times. And these really are interesting times.
We see three major trends at the present time. One of them is the potential for an unsettling of the political environment in the United States, or not just a potential, the reality. The second is the unsettling of the European community via bank problems and, let's say, Russia problems. And the third is the anxiety in the world over China. To address the first one, the concern about the world in, well, let's start with China. To address China first, we followed China for many years very closely, and there's a great deal of fear about China because China is unknowable to many Westerners. I've been there 20 times, and I really don't know it as well as I could, but we're fortunate that we have extremely good contacts in China who are experienced hands in China who speak fluent Mandarin and who've been there for many years. They're mostly Westerners, although there are some Chinese. We believe the economic fal-de-ral about China is way overdone. There is no chance that China is going to devalue their currency by 30% in the next year, as some are arguing. That's actually an absurd argument. There's no chance that China is actually growing at a negative rate of growth. It's probably growing at about 6%. They're claiming 6.5% for this year. I think this year they're actually going to grow at 6%. Last year they claimed 7%. They probably grew at 5%. Really, GDP is growing because it's transitioning from a manufacturing-based economy. The cost of goods manufactured in China has gone up so much, and the currency has gone up so much that they must raise wages. They have raised wages and made their goods harder to export. Manufacturing high value-added goods these days. They've shipped the low value-added goods over to Vietnam and Pakistan long ago. China will grow at 6% this year, probably grow at 3 or 4 or 5% over the next 5 or 6 years. Nothing to panic about. Item number two, in Europe, the banks and Russia. Russia and the banks are both problems for Europe. The banks in Europe never recapitalized after the Great Recession of 2007 and 8 because many of the loans they made to bad borrowers were done at the behest of their various governments. When the government tells you make loans to Greece, you're making loans to Greece. And when the government tells you raise more capital because you don't have enough capital because you have so many bad loans to Greece, you're going to turn around and say, hey, you made me make those bad loans to Greece, so why should I raise capital? And that's what's happened in Europe. The banks have not raised the capital that is necessary. The second thing happening in Europe that concerns us greatly is Russia and their desire to break up the European Union. Frankly, I think the European Union is a major economic mistake, but in terms of trade and the best benefits of war, no war, it's a good thing. So while I don't think it makes much sense as an economic unit, I think it makes a lot of sense as a political unit. And Russia, of course, does not like that. They're very much panicked because many of their buffer states, which they control through the Soviet Union and through the allies of the Soviet Union, have now joined NATO. Countries like, Poland, et cetera, have joined NATO. Many, and this is what caused them to do incursions into, through proxies, into Ukraine and incursions and taking over parts of Crimea and all that. It's their basic panic and paranoia, which has always existed in Russia, which believes that we want to take them over. The second point is that they've started a fight with Turkey, and we expect sometime in the next few weeks a possible fight with Turkey. The Turks have been a member of NATO since inception, and clearly if Turkey is attacked, NATO must stand in or become a toothless tiger. So this is a chance to see, and Russia's calling the bluff, I think, of NATO creating problems with Turkey, which are going to come to a head, we think, soon, and there could be wars connected with that or minor skirmishes at the very least. The other area is the United States. We don't see a recession in the United States this year, but we do see an economic banking crisis beginning in Europe, moving over in a couple of years to China, and within 3 years, probably will have some kind of recession 2 or 3 years in the United States. Not in 2016, not in 2017, but in 2018, there's a fairly high probability we'll have a recession in the United States. Inflation is moderate in the United States, although it probably is going to rise to about 1.5%. Once oil laps itself and you're no longer in a declining oil environment, and the cost of oil as a throughput in manufactured goods is worked out, then you have a lower base effect. You will probably see slightly higher inflation numbers. We think that the United States is going to grow at a very slow rate. And why is that? Because as Reinhardt and Rogoff, two professors of economics, wrote, when you have more debt in an economy, growing the economy fast is much more difficult. Most solid economists believe the Reinhardt and Rogoff's policies are view is correct. And therefore, we see very low and slow economic growth in the United States, followed by periods of recession. None of this particularly argues favorably for gold in that it doesn't create inflation, although the inflation may rise from a very low level to a more higher but still moderate level. That's not going to change the world. The other thing is, will there be a reset? Will governments all of a sudden absorb their gold into this system and create a gold-backed currency or a partially gold-backed currency, as many in the gold community hope? We think the odds of this are growing dimmer with each passing day. This does not make us bearish on gold by any means, but we think the odds of this are dimmer with each passing day. Why do we say that? We're in touch with people who broker gold in large quantities between institutions, and we know that the Chinese have been buying massive amount of golds off the books, off the markets, not in the normal market mechanism, not through the normal market mechanism, from Middle Eastern oil-producing countries who are disgorging massive amounts of gold because they need the money because of the low oil price. We know that these transactions are taking place at a discount to the market price and in large size. The argument being the seller should not throw it on the market because the price would fall 10 or 15%. So they mark it down 5 or 7%. They sell it to the Chinese mainly at a 5 to 7% discount, which the Chinese are grateful to have. This has been going on for months. In spite of that, gold has been going up in the last weeks. In addition to that, Canada has decided to go with the computer-based monetary systems and move away from metals. Believe it or not, this is Canada, and they've sold most of their gold. And other central banks that believe that gold is a barbarous relic have sold their gold, too. In spite of that, the price of gold is rising for three reasons. Reason number one, distrust of governments. Governments haven't operated effectively. They've been ineffectual. Reason number two, people are saying, well, central banks are selling gold, and now's our chance. This is the last chance to get in before the price goes up. And reason number three is it's had a good correction. It's gone sideways. It's gone down. It's built a base. And although gold could move lower, I think the wise people out there are realizing that as governments become more intrusive, you want to own more gold coins for yourself. And clearly, people who live in countries where the governments are even much more intrusive than in the developed world, for instance, in China, they want to own plenty of gold because they know just how intrusive a government can be. So for these reasons, we're positive on gold, and we're not negative on oil. We think oil is probably close to a bottom, not more than a few months away from a bottom. And some higher-yielding oil-related stocks that transport oil or natural gas are probably good buys on dips here. So we're very bullish on those sectors, but not particularly bullish on stocks and bonds in general in the world. And that's where we stand today.
You raised at least three topics that I find pertinent here to our listening base, and we'll start with the last, and that's oil. And you talk about how we might be near a bottom, you know, some folks calling for sub-$20 per barrel West Texas Intermediate crude. Your analysis would seem to indicate that might be a bit low. And we did hear, I believe it was this week, that Saudi Arabia, perhaps Russia, are going to constrict the oil output which could be a major factor, you know, if OPEC decides, well, we really aren't going to flood the market with oil anymore, we've got to do something. That might be another important point. And plus, you brought up earlier the potential for Turkey, some skirmishes there in the Middle East and other nations. That, of course, is another, I think, chess piece in the Middle East. That makes investors nervous, uncertainty increasing there. And that's interesting because a lot of our listeners here, they are invested in oil and particularly in the oil companies, which have really suffered. It's difficult to wrap one's mind around this collapse in the underlying commodity, how it has impacted the sector.
Well, we've followed oil very closely for many years because we've liked gold and oil off and on for decades. Oil is a very volatile commodity and has been volatile since I can remember, and I've been doing this for 58 years starting as a 15-year-old trading commodities and stocks. And then through college and graduate school and in my professional life as an analyst on Wall Street and elsewhere at banks, at hedge funds, and then starting my own firm. My experience has been that you can't get too emotional about oil or any commodity, but especially about oil, because there are so many variables impacting the price of the commodity. For example, we saw oil fall in 2006 from a high of 146 all the way down to about 30, and then it rallied back up to 109, 110, 115, back down to 25, 26. We believe that oil supply and demand, we believe oil demand is growing at about 1.4 million barrels a day per annum in the world, that supply can be greatly affected by people with very low cost of production, such as Saudi Arabia. And both Russia and Iran have higher costs of production than Saudi Arabia. Not only higher costs of production, higher costs of transportation to the port where it's sent away, and in many cases, inferior oil to Saudi light and Saudi medium. So basically, there is reason to think that Saudi could keep the prices down if they felt an existential threat. They do feel an existential threat. The Shiites of Iran are financing terrorism and the takeover of the government in Yemen, just south of Saudi Arabia. And they're also financing the Syrian, along with the Russians, the Syrian Alawite Shiite group, who are opposed to the Sunni Wahhabi Saudi leadership, have been for centuries, and that's not going to stop anytime soon. As a result of this, the Saudis feel an existential risk to their survival. They want the price of oil to be low enough so that it doesn't allow the financing of wars against themselves. Not to mention the fact that there's about a 20% population in Saudi Arabia of Shiites, most of whom live over where the oil fields are, as opposed to living in the more populated areas of Saudi Arabia. And there's a lot of disruption of these groups by external forces seeking to destabilize the Saudi monarchy. Because Saudi Arabia has felt an existential risk, they've lowered the price. Now, although there's no change in price and supply and demand economics, there is talk of some stabilization. It behooves Iran to get the price stabilized. It behooves Russia to get the price stabilized. It behooves Saudi Arabia less so to get the price stabilized. But eventually, if they can be sure that Iran and Russia will not cheat on the price, they will probably allow the price to rise. What has happened historically when they have had joint deals in 2001 or 2002, the Russians brokered a deal in the Mideast to cut production and therefore cause the price to rise. And then Russia went right out and cheated immediately on that deal and didn't keep their word. So everyone was supposed to cut production. Everyone else did except for Russia. Historically, when Saudi Arabia has led as a price leader and cut the price, they've been cheated on by others. Everybody says they're producing X, and they're really producing X plus 20%. This is within OPEC. So the Saudis have very little incentive to do much personal cutting. if they can't verify that others are cutting as well. That may take place, but also when you reach a price of current prices, $29 a barrel and probably 26 bottom, maybe we even get to a 22 or 4 bottom. We don't see a bottom of $10 on oil because, frankly, nobody can make money at that level, and it's practically, it's cheaper to shut in certain amount of wells and therefore decrease supply. There is a lot of inventory above ground floating around in tankers and in oil storage all over the world. The Chinese, in their normal, intelligent way, are going ahead and absorbing a lot of that, where the U.S. has not increased our oil reserve at all. And while China has increased their oil reserve by quite a lot. Clearly, that's a wise behavior. But we don't see oil going into the teens, or definitely not to $10. So we think oil is probably closer to a bottom than a top. We think worldwide demand is increasing. We think many shale plans to do shale all over the world have been disrupted by this because the cost of shale is too high to produce in many parts of the world. So global supply will still be dominated out of the Mideast, and we just have to adapt to that. The U.S. has become much more energy sufficient than they were. The argument that 67% of oil companies are in bankruptcy sounds like rubbish to me. With respect, I don't know who wrote that, but I would say that's a gross misrepresentation. We are not really panicked about oil. We think oil is near the lows. Certainly, the rate of change of decline in oil will be much lower in absolute dollar terms than it was last year. It can only go a certain amount from this level, dollar-wise. So we think we're closer to the end than the beginning of the panic. And we would be buyers of oil-producing income things like MLPs on dips. MLPs have had a terrible beating. Many of your listeners may own MLPs. We think they're a pretty wise buy at this point if they're quality MLPs who have their debt under control and who know how to run their companies correctly. I'm not talking about small operators. I'm talking about the bigger, better quality operators. They will do public offerings to raise more equity. They will pay down debt, and they will be fine. As far as the oil operators, they will be fine because oil is not going down forever. Natural gas operators have other problems because of the glut of natural gas in this country and some demand growth for natural gas in this country, but it's not growing like natural gas elsewhere, and you're not going to be able to make large quantities of money shipping natural gas abroad, making it into LNG. Just too hard to make big money at that. We like oil better than natural gas.
Thank you again for that extensive overview. I would just throw in here, that was CNN. I was quoting directly, 67 oil and gas companies in the United States filed for bankruptcy, not 67%, so I misspoke. However, 35% of oil and gas companies around the globe are at the risk of falling into bankruptcy. Again, the source, CNN.
I guess what they're talking about is they have a lot of debt. They have billions on their balance sheet owed to banks. And if the banks were to call all of that debt at some point in time because the prices are low, they couldn't repay it without doing public equity offerings or preferred stock offerings or bond offerings to the world public. And therefore, there is a risk. But I think 35% is an exaggeration as well. I think quality oil companies, big nationalists, oil companies or big independent oil companies, it can't be more than, 15-20%. On the other hand, there are many, many small operators, the Monte Guild Oil Company in Paducah, Kentucky. Maybe I'm, got a few stripper wells and maybe I'm going to go broke, so I file for bankruptcy, but that's not the same as a major company going down.
You mentioned that you see recessionary conditions in Europe spreading to China, but the United States is somewhat insulated. And I guess we can see that with, at least if you buy the official numbers, startlingly low unemployment levels relative, I guess, to the past six to 10 years, at least on the national unemployment rate. So you really don't see any trouble, if memory serves, until roughly 2018 unfolding. That implies certainly a positive scenario for equities investors, because without a recession, I really can't see any sustainable downtrend unfolding in U.S. equities. Do you feel then that pullbacks in our, let's say, S&P 500 might present a relative valuation, even with these really high PE ratios, CAPE ratios, for our long-term focused investors?
Yes, but it's a sector-by-sector thing. I don't think you can buy the SP index as a whole. In our view, you have to go to the sectors that have been battered. And what has been battered? Well, energy has been battered. So we're arguing that energy is long-term more attractive. What else has been battered? Biotechnology and medical pharma has been battered. Now, that is still too early to buy because it's a political hot potato. No lesser lights than Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and on both sides of the aisle have argued that, you know, something has to be done about drug pricing. So when you have both sides of the aisle complaining about drug pricing, it's become a favorite election season. You're probably in for some rather rocky days ahead as the election approaches. And depending on who gets elected next year, you might be having rocky days in 2017 as well. So although we love the biotech sector and we think there's some fabulous companies in it and the pharma sector, we're cautious because of these political wins. Other areas that look attractive to us, old line tech. You know, I'm not recommending Cisco here. We don't own it. It's had a big run up lately, but that kind of stock, Cisco, Hewlett Packard, IBM, I'm not recommending any of these here. But what I'm saying is these companies are showing at low PEs that they can be just as exciting, and the top line doesn't grow fast. But when it comes to cybersecurity, Cisco is eating the lunch of all the high PE players in the sector who are more pure plays. Now, it's a tiny fraction of Cisco's business, but they're still getting most of the new orders away from other more well-known, smaller cybersecurity companies. And IBM is strong in the cloud, and Microsoft is doing well in the cloud, and so on and so forth. So within technology, some of the older, solid, good quality technology companies like the ones I've mentioned may be worth looking at for your investors on dips. And another sector we like a lot, yeah, besides the MLPs and beside the biotech and beside the old line tech, there are some of the new techs, so the Facebook, the Google type of stocks. We particularly like among that group Google because it's a lower valuation than Facebook. Think Facebook's a great company. Don't think it's particularly cheap. On the other hand, we think companies like Netflix, you know, are discounting events into the future, which may have a hard time unfolding. So while we're optimistic about some of the new tech companies and think they're good buys on dips, we don't think all of the new tech companies are reasonably or even rationally priced. So we're cautious about some of the favorites. And other sectors we like include quality companies in all kinds of things like ride sharing and modern communications and telephony and utility areas. We're just looking for the better quality, good companies that have stable dividends, low debt to capitalization ratios, strong balance sheets, and are well managed. That's what we're looking at, buying on dips. We've been in very high cash position here, and we're beginning to buy more stocks as they come down.
Job cuts in the retail sector are very high. Walmart closing, shuttering 270 stores, 154 in the United States. That starts to add up. JCPenney closing down 50 stores, approximately Macy's, 36 stores, 2,500 employees. A more shocking number, I thought, names like The Gap and Finish Line, Radio Shack, Macy's, Sears, 600 stores closing down over the past 12 to 24 months. This would seem to imply some difficulty in the area. I would like your thoughts, and maybe this is outside your purview. How much of a component to this story would you estimate online retailers? For instance, Amazon, just a remarkable story there. Their strategy for, it's got to be close to 20 years. We're not going to worry about keeping our, you know, numbers in the black. We're going to concentrate on building our market share, and build market share they have. As I mentioned, in a peripheral area, provincial area, we could not even function as a family unit without Amazon. They're actually expanding along with Google into the area of unmanned drone delivery. This is catching a lot of press. I don't know if it will really be viable. Very quick delivery to your backyard with these small drones that carry the packages on sunny days. One big fan to move laterally, horizontally, four fans to keep the device aloft. Looks like it will be an important part of their delivery system. I'd like to know what you think about online retailers and specifically Amazon, please.
We like online retailing. We like online retailing delivery. That is the UPS and the FedEx and the others who will, and the U.S. Post Office who have been co-opted into helping deliver online products on Sunday, delivering packages for Amazon. Our view is that retail is in trouble. Mall-based retail is in trouble. Electronic retailing is the way to go. Retailing is not shrinking as a part of GDP. The consumer is consuming a lot of retail. 70-some-odd percent of U.S. GDP is consumer. Amazon's a great company. I personally am an Amazon Prime member, and I just bought 17 books. It's a little bit untrue because I bought 17 copies of the same book, which my grandson wrote, to distribute to people just the other day. So, yes, we use Amazon. It's big here. Everybody loves it, and they're hiring here big. They hired and opened up two major distribution centers in West Los Angeles and hired dozens of college students and young people to work in those and other people of older age. So they're a big employer around here, and they may be laying off people waiting on you at the department stores or the specialty stores, but they're adding people in the logistics and distribution network of Amazon and other online retailers. So our argument is that retailing will continue to employ just as many people, just in a different sector. As far as Amazon goes itself, we haven't owned it. And that's not because we don't think it's a great company, but because we're fundamental analysts who came up in the street doing research reports on companies and following companies closely and understanding their margins and their revenues and their growth rate and how many new units they would open. In fact, I used to be a retail analyst, actually, myself, at both a bank and at a hedge fund. So I can assure you I've looked at many financial statements of retailers. On the other hand, Amazon is a bit of a mystery. It's extremely difficult to analyze. It's extremely difficult, as you point out, to know what the earnings are going to be. And if you assume the earnings actually are going to be what they say they are for this year, the stock is selling for an immense valuation. And therefore, I can't buy it. But that doesn't mean that other people can't buy it and won't do very well owning it. If they earn the $14 they're supposed to earn next year, according to the average analyst, and $9.35, according to Bloomberg average analyst for this year, at $9.35 it's selling at 53, 55, 56 times earnings. At $14 next year, it's selling at 39, 38, 9 times earnings. These are high valuations, even for a company growing as rapidly as Amazon, which will be growing its earnings ostensibly by 600% this year and 50% next year. I like Amazon. I think it's a great company, and I certainly do business with them, but I don't know how to analyze them, so I can't own the stock.
I wonder if you would please tell us a bit more about the grandchild's success story here.
You're very kind. He's a 17-year-old who, when he was about 14, came up with a theory of mathematically based physics theory and wrote a book called Physics Reforged. And that book was written last year and is now available at Amazon. His name is Julian von Oble, and it's about quantum mechanics for the layman. It explains to the layman how quantum mechanics works, and he has his own theory called QCI theory, which explains the existence of multiple universes. And it uses a common thing, which is used all the time in electrical engineering, called imaginary numbers, and the intersection of imaginary numbers with calculus and advanced calculus and topology, which is an area of mathematics, an advanced area of mathematics. He's a high school student in the Philadelphia area, although he is quite advanced and has taken enough classes, I guess, to have a master's degree in math and probably physics while still in high school. So he starts college in a year or so, and then he'll be off to working on graduate school somewhere.
Sounds like you have a John Nash on your hands here.
It's hard to know. To be exactly accurate, he's My daughter married his father. He is not a blood relative of mine. I call him my grandson. He's actually my step-grandson. He's my daughter's stepson and my son-in-law's son. So I can claim no authorship over his intelligence, but he is a very bright kid, and he's mostly self-taught, although he's had some recent years. He's had some professors from the University of Pennsylvania helping him. He's learned a lot, but I think kids these days who are interested in physics and math often develop rather rapidly. I remember when I was a boy, I was in some math and physics classes in high school with some kids who were very, very much ahead of me. So I'm sure there's in every generation a few kids who are good at math and physics.
Early childhood mathematical genius tends not to follow into adulthood. What my advice there would be, humble advice, continue to nurture and foster this gift, because without that support, it could be a remarkable seed that just does not germinate throughout the lifetime. It really requires an extensive base, and it sounds like he has just that with his grandparents. So what a remarkable individual.
Well, that's very true. I mean, all electronic engineering is a function of imaginary numbers. Without them, it wouldn't exist.
We haven't discussed the precious metals equities, which have roared back, at least they did for a couple of weeks, almost 30% in 2 weeks. Sounds like a short covering rally, I think. Would you suggest that that might be the bottom for the XAU and the HUI? Any thoughts there?
Precious metals equities are going to move more strongly than precious metals to the upside. Our view is that that gold, which rallied to about 1260-something, will fall back to somewhere between 1187 and 1156. It got all the way down to 1191 the other day. Once that would be about a one-third retracement of its recent rally up. A one-half retracement would be about 1156. Anywhere in that region, and probably the other day we hit it, you can buy gold, but what we're buying is we're buying gold shares or ETFs of the big cap gold shares, because it's our view that the gold shares, having suffered much more than gold on the downside, will come back much more rapidly on the upside. We also see good economic news in that people are disgorging ineffectual mines, low profit mines, losing mines, or closing them down, and so on. This means supply will decrease and price will increase. So we're bullish on gold shares, on pullbacks.
Would you like to leave parting information?
Thanks, Chris, for having me on your show. And I'm going to have to call you on the phone, and we'll talk a little about some of your interesting math activities. I just would like to thank you for your kindness in having me and to speak to your very intelligent and able audience and to communicate our views.
Any contact information? I'm sure you'd like to tell folks more about Guild.
Well, we basically manage money for private individuals. We're a family office. We mainly manage our own money. Also manage money for some wealthy families and private individuals. Minimum count about $1 million. We're located in Los Angeles. We have a lot of analysts per dollar under management, and we're not everybody here is 73 years old. We have my partner's 49 years old, another partner's in his late 30s. We have a number of very strong analytical talents at the firm in their 30s and 40s. So we think we'll be around for a long time and look forward to being of service to anyone interested. You can reach us under guildinvestment.com on the web.
Very good. We're going to have that link up there for you and look forward to having you back on the show.
Thank you, Chris, and congratulations on the new on the fund.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, Bill Murphy at the helm of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, GATA, with Chris Powell working on behalf of investors around the world. Welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Great to be here, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's been a good year. We've seen the precious metals equities up 30% in 2 weeks. The shorts are running for the hills. It's good news. Tell us what's going on.
Seems to be over. From a GATA standpoint, it's been pretty clear all year that the gold cartel is losing control of their price suppression schemes, which have buried us for the past 4 years. And there's a lot of rules and things they do over and over again. And one by one, they're falling apart. I mean, the most obvious one to many people and your listeners is just the way gold is trading and the spikes it's made out of nowhere. We had that $70 up day, for example, and we didn't get anything like that for years and went up for no reason. Physical demand is such that it's putting the gold cartel on notice, and it's giving them fits in the sense of it's really eating into their ability to suppress the price because it's eating up all their physical supply. That's why you have this volatility we have. Now, we haven't seen volatility like this. I don't know. I can't. Even in the bull market, it wasn't as volatile as we've seen of late.
The real question is, will we see a continuation of this trend? I mean, look, the Federal Reserve backpedaling on rates, the ECB, as well as the Bank of Japan with Shinzo Abe, surprise negative rate cut. And now the Fed is, as I said, backpedaling. We might not have but one more rate hike, if even that, in 2015.
Well, from my standpoint, quantitative easing has meant nothing. Zero interest rates has meant nothing. Nothing matters except what the gold cartels are able to get away with. We're dealing with here with the market commotion and the bank, big banks having such trouble. It's creating all kinds of uncertainty, as you're talking about, and it's got people buying gold that haven't been around before, and it's incredible demand because people can see what's going on. But the real issue is that the gold cartel is running out of physical supply, and all of a sudden these things, like you're talking about, are of importance. But good grief, I mean, you could have had gold double in price over the past years for the same reason, and yet it was taken down $850. But it's a very exciting time, and as we're talking, we have a two-way game now. In the past, it was a one-way street. Now it comes back in hours. So we have a chance for a price explosion here. And as you mentioned, the shares, the HUI went up 70% off its low in 6 weeks. That's extraordinary.
I hadn't even looked at that. I was looking at the XAU.
What happened, Chris, is that the HUI in early January made an attempt to break the HUI base of around 100. And we talked about it at the time. Nothing else was going on that day. The HUI dropped 7 points. And we all said, what the heck is going on? And we figured they were going after stops because the end game was near. And sure enough, it's gone straight up since then. A week later, the silver fix, you know all about that bizarre thing, was silver's at 1420 or so. It goes down to 1358 for the fix, goes right back up again after ripping everybody off. Then silver goes right to 16. All these are signs, and the reason I'm getting into it, of the gold cartel is gradually falling apart here. And it's great for our industry.
For those of us who are technically inclined, there was a remarkably bearish head and shoulders pattern in the XAU and HUI. And as soon as that neckline was broken, it reversed. And that's when the fireworks started here against the cartel. It was just one of those reversals that catches the last folks to start selling. But let's talk about the underlying metals. Gold, yellow metal. You know, looks like it could be on its way to 1400, might test that level, 1500 this year. If we eclipse 1500 gold, if we can break through 20 to 22 on silver, what happens?
What a lot of people don't understand, and I can understand that, is you see, sometimes they talk about gold being technically overbought and so on. It is, but at times. But it is the most fundamentally oversold market maybe in history, except for silver. And, you know, it should be more than double the price today. So that's now what's kicking in, this big fundamental undervaluation with artificially low prices. And when it comes to silver, it's the deadest market I've ever seen, and it's because of the gold cartel, because it's their kryptonite, and they're losing control of gold, desperately afraid of losing control of silver. Just look at the low volatility in silver versus the high volatility in gold. It's like it's got an anchor attached to it, that if silver takes off, it's going to go bananas, and their whole scheme will end for good. And that's why we're seeing in silver. I think it's the most explosive thing I've ever seen in 40 years, in the sense of your up downside is $1 to $2, upside's $100, probably $150. And they know what's coming, and I think they're on their this is the last gasp, but they just won't. Every day you look at the thing and you just go, what the heck's going on here? And we think we've got it figured out, and only time will tell if we do.
Silver is really an interesting story because I think it suffered so much as the CRB has been really beaten down in the last few years, that industrial component. But, you know, in the final analysis in silver, its weakness, I think, becomes its strength. It hasn't even asserted its monetary strength yet. I don't think we've even seen a hint of that, even in 2011, you know, when it approached $50. When it hits 50 this next time, it's not going to fall back. There's not going to be anything to stop it. Not only is there scarcity due to industrial, we're actually expecting the economy, the U.S. economy domestically, to surprise a lot of folks and chug along for the next 2 or 3 years. And that's actually going to hurt the U.S. dollar, which now we think is broken, is now a broken market. Anything else on your radar screen that investors need to be watching?
Just to finish up on silver, because to me, it's, you know, it's got this massive base. It's explosive. Once they lose control and they're desperate to stop it, and for me, it's just a number, but 1850 is the key. You've had a smaller base completed, but if 1850 is taken out, Katie barred the door on the upside, and I think the shares are going to go ballistic. You know, they're priced for oblivion still, even though a lot of them, some of the good ones like First Majestic, have really rallied pretty good, but that's nothing compared to what's coming. And I think it's a very exciting time. And the good news is for our camp is they can attack, and which we see them doing all the time now. But the demand is such, especially in gold, that it's giving them fits. So at any time here, especially if we have more financial market turmoil in the stock markets, the bids are going to come into gold and the safe haven kind of sort of thing. And it could take out, you know, the recent highs at 1262 easily and shoot for your 1,400. But the real number is when the fun starts, when it gets above 2,000, which may not be as far off as people think.
Gold and silver, these are still tiny markets, and now they've been halved, silver more so. And when you start to compare the ridiculous price-to-earnings ratios, especially in the high-flying tech sector and equities, one of these companies, reminiscent of the dot-com days, 200, 300, 500 triple-digit price-to-earnings ratio, that's unsustainable. You know, the prices are going to return to the mean. The market cap on just one of these semi-blue-chip stocks, and when that money, when that, let's call it the smart money, in quotations, when that starts to reverse, you're talking about putting a Niagara size water flow through a 1 foot funnel. I mean, it's got to be something in reverse. And I can't wait to see silver return to its more, as you know, historical gold to silver ratio in the neighborhood of 1 to 20, 1 to 10.
Well, hopefully I've answered that. You know it, buying these dips is the way to go, and versus the years past of selling the rallies. And I expect the gold cartel to further lose control of what they've done, and the key will be silver taken at 1850. If we see that, that's just my opinion. You know, look out, you're going to get that kind of moves you're talking about, and it's going to be quite exciting. Already it's been a great year, and exciting versus going to sleep in years past and always being so negative. Now it's exciting, and heck, we could be down $20 in gold in a day, and the next day be up again. And that just hasn't happened in 4 to 5 years. So a lot of fun ahead.
And focus on the opportunity here. Let's skip trying to outsmart and time these markets and just start dollar cost averaging. Now is the time. Bill Murphy, always appreciate your thoughts. Keep up the good work, sir.
Thank you, Chris. Say hello to Peter.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. If you've dared to watch with any frequency any of the recent presidential debates, Republican or Democrat, at least at this juncture, there is one takeaway message that is resonating and that will ultimately resonate first at a subliminal or subconscious level, then when it can no longer be hidden, very consciously, despite whatever popularity any particular candidate may have at this moment in time. And that is, no one is coming to the rescue. The challenges are so big. The debt, the derivatives, the potential for a financial repeat of 2008, and then some. Unfortunately, the presidential debates are akin, once again, to all-star wrestling, or those awful popularity contests in school, shallow and superficial. Real issues, serious issues seem to be glossed over as usual, and will be until people begin to realize that no one is coming to the rescue. One of my mentors and coaches during a pivotal point in my speaking career was the late Dr. Nathaniel Brandon. He originally told the story about how no one was coming to the rescue, and how ultimately each of us is responsible for finding creative solutions to the challenges and setbacks of life. He jokingly said one of his clients had disagreed with him on that analysis and said, "But Nathaniel, that's not true, because you came to the rescue." To which he replied, "Yes, and I came to tell you that no one was coming." When you grasp the importance of the meaning of that story, you will realize very quickly, if not instantaneously, that you, and only you, are responsible for navigating the challenges of change. No one can do it for you. It's an important message to keep in mind as you watch and listen to these debates. Because no matter what promises or reforms are made or championed by a candidate, it's possible no one will be in a position to ultimately keep their word. Why? Because financial force majeure will likely rule the day during this next presidential administration, regardless of who wins. And because the banking crisis has never really ended, and the real estate crisis has never really ended, and the financial crisis has never really ended, financial force majeure, when it takes center stage, can trump the Fed, can trump Hillary, can trump Bernie, can trump Cruz, Rubio, and yes, financial force majeure can even trump Trump. No one is coming to the rescue. The evolution of the solution, of your solution, lies within you. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.